Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. Today, I'm going to cover 2 Kings chapter 11. This will be the story of Queen Athalia of Judah and her successor, the little 7-year-old boy, Joash of Judah. Our context is this. We've just seen some bloody events of the year 841 BC, where Athalia's brother, who was king of northern Israel, Joram, he got killed in 841 BC by Jehu, the usurper. And Jehu also killed Athalia's son, Ahaziah, who was king of southern Israel, Judah. And all of that was covered in the last several chapters. And so now we start in chapter 11, verse 1, 2 Kings. When Athalia, the mother of Ahaziah, saw that her son was dead, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Now, why was her son dead? We covered that in the last chapter. He ran from Jezreel after Joram, his uncle, got shot in the back by Jehu, the usurper. And Ahaziah, the nephew of Joram, had gone up there because Joram was recovering at Jezreel from a wound he had sustained in a battle at Ramoth Gilead. Well, his uncle Joram is dead, and then Ahaziah flees, and after some confusing maneuverings between a place called Ibleam and Samaria and Megiddo, he ends up dying at Megiddo. And so Athalia now finds out, she's back in the south, she's in Judah, that her son was dead. Now, Athalia was the wife of Ahaziah's father, Jehoram of Judah, who ruled from 848 to 841. And so Athalia was the queen during those years. And now in 841, with Jehoram dead and Ahaziah dead, she's still the queen mother. I always keep thinking you ought to call somebody like that the queen grandmother, but that's not the way it works. So she's the queen mother. And she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Now, Athalia, let's look at her relationships. She was the daughter of King Ahab, the wicked King Ahab of northern Israel. Ahab ruled between 874 and 853. Athalia was the sister of two northern Israelite kings, namely Ahaziah and Joram. So Athalia is the sister of the northern Ahaziah, who ruled between 853 and 852. And, of course, Ahaziah is the son of Ahab and Jezebel. And Athalia is also the sister of Joram, the northern Joram, J-O-R-A-M, who ruled between 852 and 841. So she comes from a long line of illustrious pagan royalty. She was given to Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, to marry the son of Jehoshaphat, Jehoram of Judah, in a marriage alliance between Ahab of the north and Jehoshaphat of the south. Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram married Ahab's daughter Athalia, and so that's how she ended up down in the south. She's the mother of Ahaziah, and as we'll see, she had much influence over Ahaziah, but now Ahaziah is dead. Now, what about Athalia's character? Well, she inherited much of her character from her mother Jezebel, as the pulpit commentary points out. She had unlimited ascendancy over her husband Jehoram, and she dominated her son, the southern Ahaziah. I call him the southern Ahaziah because there was a northern Ahaziah, Athalia's brother, who was the first king to take over after Ahab died. He was the king that ruled for 2 years and then fell through a lattice. So Athalia had a brother named Ahaziah and a son named Ahaziah. I'm sure the son was named after the brother. So at any rate, going back to her character, she dominated her husband Jehoram and she dominated her son Ahaziah. We see the domination of Jehoram in 2 Kings 8:18. He, that's Jehoram, walked in the way of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done, for Ahab's daughter was his wife. That's Athalia. Athalia was Jehoram's wife. Jehoram did what was evil in the Lord's sight. Well, and why was that? Most probably because of Athalia, who brought Baal worship down to Judah. Now, Athalia also dominated her son as well as her husband. Her son was named Ahaziah. That's Ahaziah, the southern king of Judah, who ruled for 1 year in 841, or part of 1 year. We see how she induced Ahaziah to continue Baal worship, 2 Kings 8:27. Ahaziah walked in the way of the house of Ahab and did what was evil in the Lord's sight, like the house of Ahab, for he was a son-in-law to Ahab's family. Because he was married to Athalia into Ahab's family, that's why he did evil in the Lord's sight. And of course, that's defined as idolatry, doing evil in the Lord's sight in the books of Kings and Chronicles. So She was a much bad woman. And to prove it, in the end of verse 1, she rose and destroyed all the royal offspring. Now, royal is talking about Ahaziah. So the offspring of Ahaziah are Ahaziah's sons. Now, the potential members of the house of Judah who could inherit the throne, many of them had already been killed. The brothers of Jehoram of Judah, Athaliah's husband, he ruled from 848 to 841 B.C., well, they had already been killed by Jehoram when he took over in 848. 2 Chronicles 21:4. Now, when Jehoram had taken over the kingdom of his father and made himself secure, his father Jehoshaphat made himself secure, he killed all his brothers with the sword and some of the rulers of Israel also. So he had killed all his brothers, so they're gone. So Ahaziah's uncles have been wiped out by his father Jehoram, and now we're going to see that Ahaziah's brothers have also been wiped out by some marauding Arabs. 2 Chronicles 22:1. Then the inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah king in Joram's place, made Ahaziah his, Joram's youngest son, king in Joram's place, for the band of men who came with the Arabs to the camp had slain all the older sons. So Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. He began to reign, but all of his brothers had been wiped out by his father. So he's lost all of his uncles. He's lost all of his brothers. Well, Athaliah's going to keep going until she almost finishes the job, except for little King Joash. What were her motives in killing? We're going to look at, well, let's look at right now who she probably killed. Now, these options are not mutually exclusive, but the first option is she killed Ahaziah's sons. Now, this option is definite because we look at verse 2. We see that Joash is being rescued from the king's sons who were being killed. They were hidden from Athaliah. So she's wiping out Ahaziah's sons. So that means Ahaziah has lost his uncles, his brothers, and his sons. And of course, that means that Athaliah is murdering her own grandchildren. A real peach of a woman this woman was. Now, some other options as to who she could have been wiping out. Matthew Poole suggests that Jehoram, Athaliah's husband, he might have had children by another wife, because these kings didn't have just one wife. They had concubines. So he might have had another wife or another concubine and had some sons that were still living, and she could have wiped them out. Also, the 42 nephews who had been killed by Jehu, I think I've mentioned them already. Maybe I didn't, but in our previous chapter, we saw Jehu wiping out 42 of the relatives. It says, it doesn't say nephews, but the brothers had already been wiped out. As we know, as I just said, the Arabs had wiped out the brothers of Ahaziah, so the relatives are probably the sons of those brothers, i.e. Ahaziah's nephews. And there were 42 of them. Well, they might have had sons, so that would be grandnephews of Ahaziah that could have been killed. And the pulpit commentary suggests that maybe other descendants of David were in Jerusalem from branches other than that of King Rehoboam, who was also a son of David, a son of Solomon, but of the house of David. Well, that's getting way out there. Just to keep it easy, let's just know that Athaliah killed her son Ahaziah's sons. She murdered her own grandchildren. So that's who she's killing here. Now, what were her motives? Well, one motive is she might have wanted to rule. She was queen when her husband Jehoram was king. And then when Jehoram died, she was queen mother while her son Ahaziah was on the throne. Well, now Ahaziah is dead. And so her power is getting further and further in the rearview mirror. And so maybe she figured she had to kill all the male aspirants so that she could be queen, which she was for 6 years, as we'll see. Another one of her possible motives is she did not want David's family to outlive her family, as Jameson Fawcett Brown and Matthew Poole suggest. You recall the 70 descendants of Ahab who all had their heads put in a basket by Jehu? So they're gone, and then the 42 nephews of Ahaziah were slaughtered by Jehu. Those were Athaliah's grandnephews. They're gone. Those 70 heads that were in a basket put there by Jehu, carried from Samaria to Jezreel, well, those were members of Ahab's family, and Athaliah was a member of Ahab's family. So all of her family's getting wiped out. Let's read that in 2 Kings 10:7. We'll see the 70 heads in the basket. When the letter came to them, they took the king's sons. That was a letter from Jehu to the officials of Samaria. Jehu was in Jezreel at the time. The officials took the king's sons and slaughtered all 70, put their heads in baskets, and sent them to Jehu at Jezreel. And then the 42 nephews or relatives, probably nephews, probably Athaliah's grandnephews, they were slaughtered by Jehu, 2 Kings 10:14. Then Jehu ordered, take them alive. So they took them alive and then slaughtered them at the pit of Betheked, 42 men. Betheked is halfway between Jezreel and Samaria, or partway. So she's worried that her family's about to get extinguished. That's another reason why she destroyed all the sons of Ahaziah. A third possible reason is she was actually concerned about her own life. She wanted to act in self-defense against Jehu, who had already wiped out her grandnephews and who had already killed her son. This is Jameson, Fawcett, Poole, and Poole's idea. Jehu was committed to destroy all of Ahab's family, and she was of Ahab's family. And the king or the people of Judah may well have delivered Athaliah to Jehu if Jehu had asked for Athaliah. And that would probably be a reasonable demand for Jehu to make. The kingdom of Judah being in total disarray and Jehu having established his rule in Israel, he could say, okay, I've killed as many Ahabites as I can, if I can make up a word, but I haven't gotten Athaliah yet. So, Judah, how about deliver her to me? And Athaliah, she's a smart woman. She's a queen. She's going to be a queen. And she realizes that her life's in danger, so she's trying to kill all the people who might deliver her over to Jehu. Another reason is she might have wanted to establish the worship of Baal. She had introduced it already into Judah, and she realized that the Yahweh worshippers might wipe Baal out, and she might be religious enough, devoted to Baal enough, that she wanted to protect Baal. So she had a lot of reasons for killing all these people. She was a murderess. We go to 2 Kings 11, verses 2 through 4. Jehosheba, who was King Jehoram's daughter and Ahaziah's sister, secretly rescued Joash, son of Ahaziah, from the king's sons who were being killed, and put Joash and the one who nursed him in a bedroom. So Joash was hidden from Athaliah and was not killed. Joash was in hiding with Jehosheba in the Lord's temple 6 years while Athaliah ruled over the land. Then in the 7th year, Jehoiada sent messengers and brought in the commanders of hundreds, the Karaites, and the guards. He had them come to him in the Lord's temple, where he made a covenant with them and put them under oath. He showed them the king's son. Now this Jehosheba is said to be King Joram's daughter. Remember, Joram is Ahaziah's father, the deceased Ahaziah, the one-year wonder who ruled for a part of 841, Athaliah's son. That Ahaziah, he's been killed now already. He died up at Megiddo in the last chapter. He's dead, but he had a half-sister named Jehosheba. Now, Jehosheba was not Athaliah's daughter, but she was King Joram's daughter. So Jehoram and Athaliah were married, but Jehoram had a daughter by a concubine named Jehosheba, or another wife. How do we know that, by the way? John Gill proves it this way. We know that Jehosheba married a high priest from Chronicles. I'll read you that verse later. And a high priest would not have married the daughter of such an adulterous woman as Athaliah. So Jehosheba is not tainted by having Athaliah as her mother. So she's a half-sister of Ahaziah. She secretly rescued Joash from all of the sons that Athaliah is killing. Now here's some possible ways that Joash was not found in order to be murdered. Athaliah's murderer, or the murderer that was directed to murder by Athaliah, he perhaps mistakenly thought Joash was dead and then threw him in with the other bodies. And then Joash was plucked from amongst the dead. That's a little gruesome. Another option is that a nurse might have put him among the dead to make the murderers of the sons, to make those murderers think that Joash was dead when he wasn't dead. And then the nurse told Jehosheba, and Jehosheba went and rescued Joash from among the dead. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown has a third option. Perhaps Joash was stolen from the palace nursery before the murders took place, and then he was hidden by Jehosheba in the temple. I think that's the most reasonable option to me. Now, verse 3 says that Joash was in hiding in the temple for 6 years. That's easily enough done. No one had access to the temple but the priest. And Jehoiada, Jehosheba's husband, he was the high priest, and he's in charge over the whole temple. So that's how it was easily done. I used to think that was a difficult thing. I don't think so. Now let's take a look at Joash. His mother was Zibiah of Beersheba. We know from 2 Kings 12:1, in the 7th year of Jehu, Joash became king and reigned 40 years. So we're going to see that this little 7-year-old boy, well, he's 1-year-old now, but he's at the end of the 6 years of hiding in the temple, he's going to be 7 years old and become king. His mother was Zibiah from Beersheba. Joash was a descendant of David, and that's important because he was the last descendant of David, all the rest having been killed by Athaliah. So if Joash had gone down, so would have the whole line of David gone down, and that would have apparently voided the prophecies of David's lineage. So Jehoiada, who was a priest and concerned about the house of David and the prophecies of Nathan to David, he had good motive to revolt against Athaliah. His own wife, Jehosheba, had a better claim to the throne than Athaliah did. She was of the line of David. Athaliah wasn't from the line of David. She was a Baal worshiper. Also, Jehoiada was a high priest, and a high priest would want to defend legal Yahweh worship, whereas Athaliah was trying to destroy legal Yahweh worship by instituting the worship of Baal. So Jehosheba and Jehoiada are going to effect a palace revolution and shortly get Athaliah killed 6 years later. Now, as I said, Joash was hidden in the temple in verse 3. There were many side rooms in Solomon's temple, and I guess that's one good reason for having gone through all the details of Solomon's temple when we did that in a previous audio, because I can see the construction now in my head, and there was lots and lots and lots of these little side rooms on three sides of the temple. And one of them was a bedroom they made for little King Joash, and he lived there for 6 years. And from that we can deduce that Joash was 1 year old when he was put into hiding, because he was 7 years old when he became king, as we read in 2 Kings 12:1. And if he was 7 years old when he became king and he ruled for 6 years, he hid for 6 years in the temple in verse 3 of this chapter, well then that makes him 1 year old when he went into hiding. Now he hid while Athaliah ruled. Athaliah ruled from 841 to 835. Now this is the only example, Athaliah is, of a queen ruling in Israel. That's not a very good example for feminists who love to say women can lead just as well as men can. And sometimes you might hear a feminist mention Athaliah as an example of feminine rule, and sometimes they mention Jezebel. And I just love to hear them say that. I say, that's great. So you want to use, as someone to buttress your evangelical feminist arguments, you want to use a usurper and a murderer like Athaliah and a nasty murdering bitch like Jezebel? You want to do that and then talk to me about how women ought to rule the kingdom? Well, please, let's talk about Deborah maybe before we talk. Maybe Maggie Thatcher. But don't talk about Athaliah and Jezebel. Now this Jehoiada, who is the husband of Jehosheba, how do we know he's the high priest? 2 Chronicles 22:11. And in this passage, Jehosheba is going to be called Jehoshabeath. It's the same person. I'm going to call her Jehosheba. 2 Chronicles 22:11, Jehoshabeath, the king's daughter, rescued Joash, son of Ahaziah, from the king's sons who were being killed, and put him and the one who nursed him in a bedroom. So Joash had a nurse with him as he was 1 year old, 2 years old, had somebody to take care of him. Maybe even wet nursed him, I don't know. Now Jehosheba was the daughter of King Jehoram, and the wife of Jehoiada the priest, and that's how we know she was married to Jehoiada the priest. Doesn't say high priest. I don't know how we know he's the high priest, but he's a priest. Since she, Jehosheba, was Ahaziah's sister, she hid Joash from Athaliah so that Athaliah did not kill Joash. Now, captains of hundreds are mentioned in verse 4. Messengers were sent to them by Jehoiada, and they had a nice little political conspiracy. He made a covenant with them, put them under oath. Serious business. Now, all of these soldiers and people in this conspiracy can get to be pretty confusing here. Well, in verse 4, captains of the hundreds are mentioned. We'll just take those as the head of the courses of priests and Levites that came to minister to the temple. You recall that the year was divided up, I think, into 24 courses. So every couple of weeks, a new course of priests would come in from the hinterlands into Jerusalem, and the course of priests and Levites that was on duty before would leave and go back home. And so they would just have 2 week shifts. Well, that's what we're talking about here. And also in verse 4, the guard is mentioned. That would be the temple guard. Those are Levites who are in charge of temple security. Could have been a palace guard, not the temple guard, but a palace guard. Soldiers who were serving under the late King Ahaziah, whom Athaliah would have turned out of their post as soon as Ahaziah was killed and she took over. But I don't think so. I think it's the temple guard. Now, one other confusing word about these conspirators. Not only do you have the commanders of the hundreds, I take that to be the heads of the Levites and the priests and your guards. I take those are the Levites who are the temple guards. Then we have mentioned the Kerites. Well, I'm going to give you a good suggestion as to who the Kerites were. Of course, nobody really knows for sure. This is from a website called www.phoenixdatasystems.com. So I don't know who the brother is that wrote this, but I thought this was pretty interesting. He mentions that some scholars conclude that these Kerites were probably mercenaries from Caria. Caria is on the southwestern coast of Anatolia. Very famous place, actually. If you read ancient history, it's mentioned all the time. And so these mercenaries could have been somehow hired by Jehoiada or by a previous king of Judah. That's one option. But the interesting option that this brother comes up with is that they were Cherethites. The Kerites were Cherethites. Now, who were the Cherethites? They were the long-established Philistine bodyguard of David. Philistines who, well, assuming that Cherethites means Philistines, that's controverted too. But a lot of people think that the Cherethites were Philistines who David had won over to his side and who he placed in his bodyguard. Now, let me read from this website. If the Kerites had always been part of the royal bodyguard, why did they turn on Athaliah? The logical answer is that they recognized that Athaliah was not of the house of David to whom they first swore allegiance. Since Joash was a direct descendant of David, Jehoiada did not have to do any arm twisting to get them to help place Joash on the throne. All right, well, that makes sense that the Kerites would be Cherethites, but also there are linguistic reasons for saying that the Kerites are the Cherethites. Again, reading from the website, Kerites in transcription from Hebrew is Kari, K-A-R-I, and the transcriptions for the Cherethites of David's bodyguard is Kereti, K-E-R-E-T-I, so you see how close it is. Well, it's an interesting theory. It's good enough for me. But all of the conspirators came to the temple. They made a covenant, and Jehoiada showed the conspirators the king's son, Joash, the little one-year-old boy. Now, some people have speculated that Jehoiada must have certainly discussed all of his conspiratorial plans before they actually made this covenant here. Some discussion must have gone on, and other people say that there had to have been a festival as being used as a pretext for getting everybody to come in for a festival, one of the three yearly festivals, because otherwise they would have gotten caught, perhaps. But at any rate, however they did it, they made the covenant with each other. The conspiracy to commit treason, they showed the conspirators, Jehoiada and Jehoshaphat did, they showed the conspirators Joash, and you might think, well, how do the conspirators know that this little baby really is Joash? Well, remember the nurse who had been staying with Joash for six years? She could say, this little boy, who is now 7 years old, this little boy is indeed Joash. And of course, Jehoshaphat could vouch for the boy's identity too. So we go down to 2 Kings 11, verses 5 through 8. We're in the middle of a sentence, so let me go back and pick up the last sentence of verse 4. He, Jehoiada, showed the conspirators the king's son, and verse 5, and commanded the conspirators. This is what you are to do. A third of you who come on duty on the Sabbath are to provide protection for the king's palace. A third are to be at the sewer gate, and a third at the gate behind the guards. You are to take turns providing protection for the palace. Your two divisions that go off duty on the Sabbath are to provide protection for the Lord's temple. You must completely surround the king with weapons in hand. Anyone who approaches the ranks is to be put to death. You must be with the king in all his daily task. The king, of course, is talking about Joash. He's not king yet, but he's going to be. Now, this is a confusing section of scripture, so let's try to simplify it a little bit. First of all, you've got Levites and priests coming in for their duty, and you've got some that are going off for their duty. So I'll make that distinction. Now, the ones that are coming in are divided up into thirds. They're the ones that are supposed to protect the palace. Now, they also have to protect the temple, so the off-duty Levites and priests who are leaving the temple, they're going to take care of the temple. So you got two places that need to be taken care of, the palace and the temple. The palace is where Athaliah lived. And then you got to take care of the temple because that's where the young 7-year-old King Joash is in hiding. Now, these three-thirds of these Levites and priests who are coming into Jerusalem and into the temple, they're going to easily come in because that's what they normally do. We're just priests. We're Levites. We're coming in to serve in the temple. We're not armed, of course. They wouldn't be armed. And plus, Jehoiada is the high priest, and he's behind the conspiracy. Well, he tells the priest when to come in. So there's absolutely nothing suspicious here. Notice that he did this on a Sabbath, because that's when the courses switched out on the Sabbath. So everything is cool and not suspicious. Now, let me read you a comment from Ellicott, the commentator. There were two places to be occupied for the success of the present movement, viz., the royal palace and the temple, the king's house and the house of the Lord. The king's house is the royal palace, and the house of the Lord is the temple. In the former, in the king's house, was Athalia, the usurping queen, whose movements must be closely watched and whose adherents must be prevented from occupying and defending the palace. In the latter, that means in the house of the Lord of the temple, the young heir to the throne who must be protected from attack. So they had to box in Athalia in the temple, and they had to protect the king, Joash, the new king, in the temple. And the Levites and priests coming in took care of the temple, and those who were going out, the courses coming in, who are divided up into thirds, they're coming in, they take care of the palace. And then the courses going out, the Levites and the priests going off duty on that Sabbath day, they were to take care of the temple. Sounds like a well-designed conspiracy. And by the way, in verse 6, the thirds of the incoming course of priests and Levites that are protecting the palace, they rotate. It says you are to take turns providing protection for the palace. So they are rotating from gate to gate. There were three gates mentioned. The first gate is the Sur gate. The word signifies go back. So the Jews generally think it's the eastern gate. I don't know why. Well, they say that those who were defiled were to go back through that gate. And I'm assuming these are gates of the temple, not of the city. The Sur gate is also called gate of the foundation in 2 Chronicles 23:5 in the parallel passage. That's one gate. The second gate is called the gate behind the guards. In Chronicles, it's called, it's sometimes translated as the threshold gate. Gill says it's the southern gate. Again, I think that's of the temple. So a third of the incoming priests and Levites actually go to the king's palace. And then the other two-thirds are distributed between two gates that are nearby. I don't think anybody knows exactly where these gates are. I'm almost 99.99% sure of that. And so Jehoiada says, don't let anybody in. If anybody tries to come in, either to rescue Athalia or to capture little King Joash, put him to death. You got to stay with the king all the time in his daily task, whatever that was. A 7-year-old boy having daily tasks, you wonder what they are. Maybe daily activities might be a little bit better. We go down to 2 Kings 11, verses 9 and 10. So the captains of hundreds did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded, and each one of them took his men who were to come in on the Sabbath with those who were to go out on the Sabbath, and came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest gave to the captains of hundreds the spears and shields that had been King David's, which were in the house of the Lord. All right, so discussion is over. Action is beginning. The priest and the Levites come in, who were going to take care of the temple. They came in to do their duty as the courses were being changed, and then they were given weapons. Well, how would they have weapons? They came in unarmed. How would they have weapons? Well, it was a common practice to put weapons taken from enemies in temples in the ancient Near East, and the Israelites did it too. Here's some scriptural examples. 1 Samuel 21:9, the priest, this is the priest at Nob, where David had fled, being chased by Saul. The priest replied, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, is here." Is where? In the tabernacle at Nob. "Wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you want to take it for yourself, then take it, for there isn't another one here. There's none like it. Give it to me." So, even in a tabernacle, you have a military weapon. It seems sort of incongruent, but there you have it. 2 Samuel 8:7, David took the gold shields of Hadadezer's officers. Hadadezer's a Syrian king. Took the gold shields of Hadadezer's officers and brought them to Jerusalem. And then in verse 11, 2 Samuel 8, King David also dedicated these to the Lord. Dedicated to the Lord means he put them in the temple, along with the silver and gold he had dedicated from all the nations he had subdued. So these weapons were probably kept in the many storerooms on the side of the temple. And so the priest came in, no suspicion, goes every two Saturdays. They come in, they change the courses, no big deal, everything's normal. They're not armed. Why would any of Athalia's guards be suspicious in the least? And then, once they're in the temple, Jehoiada distributes weapons to them, spears and shields that had been King David's. These are the same spears and shields I just talked about. Goliath, when he beat Goliath and when he beat Hadadezer, they were stored in the temple. And now they're being put to good use. They're no longer merely ornamental. They're going to get rid of the nasty old Athalia. We go now to 2 Kings 11, 11 through 14. Then the guards stood with their weapons in hand, surrounding the king, from the right side of the temple to the left side, by the altar and by the temple. He brought out the king's son, that's Jehoiada, brought out the king's son, that's Joash. And of course it says the king's son, that would be Ahaziah's son, Joash. Put the crown on him, did Jehoiada, gave him the testimony and made him king. They anointed him and clapped their hands and cried, Long live the king. When Athaliah heard the noise from the guard and the crowd, she went out to the people at the Lord's temple. As she looked, there was the king standing by the pillar according to the custom. The commanders of the trumpeters were by the king, and all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets. Athaliah tore her clothes and screamed, Treason! Treason! Now, the fact that they were rejoicing and blowing trumpets must have been a reflection upon what they thought, a reflection of their attitude, of what they thought about their beloved queen Athaliah. Apparently they weren't too happy with her. Now these guards surrounded the king. It is not clear from what I just read exactly how the guards were arrayed. I'm going to give you two options. I'm going to give you the east-west option, and I'm going to give you the north-south option. Cambridge Commentary has the east-west option. Let me read that. The altar stood in the court in front of the temple porch. And of course, as we know, the layout of the temple was facing east. It had a courtyard, and then it had a porch in front of the holy place. And the altar of burnt offering, the bronze altar, was in front of that porch, to the east of the porch. The porch was to the west of the altar. Cambridge continues, from each corner of the porch, on the left and the right, in other words, on the northern side and on the southern side, the men were ranged in lines between the temple and the altar, so that when the king came forth, he would advance between them, and the lines gradually came toward each other as they neared the altar, so that it can be said of them that they were along by the altar and by the house. The space enclosed by them would be somewhat triangular in form, the base being the width of the temple porch. And, of course, the other side of the parallelogram would be the width of the bronze altar. Into this space Joash was brought forth, and there proclaimed and anointed in the sight of the people. The people are said to have been gathered in the temple courts in front of the bronze altar. That makes a lot of sense to me. You just got ranks of soldiers, maybe one rank, maybe more than one rank, and they're going east and west from the edge of the porch to the edge of the bronze altar, forming a nice little walkway for the little king to walk through. The pulpit commentary, however, says that the soldiers were arrayed from north to south, not east to west, but north to south. Let me read what the pulpit commentary says. Quote, the guard was drawn up right across the temple court from wall to wall, probably in several ranks, both before and behind the king. So the king would walk, so there would be a rank of soldiers in front of the porch going from the north wall to the south wall. The king would come walk through that rank of soldiers and walk toward the bronze altar. And then there would be another rank of soldiers going from north to the south, either in front or behind the altar. I don't know. I don't like that solution. I think it makes more sense to take the Cambridge solution as to where the soldiers formed an alleyway or a walkway so that the king could walk through. Now in verse 11, when it says these guards were surrounding the king, that's spoken in anticipation. The king hasn't come out yet, but when he does, he's going to be walking through those soldiers. Now it says in verse 11, when the king did come out, that Jehoiada gave him the testimony. What is the testimony? Well, it's probably the book of the law, as John Gill says. Well, actually, John Gill says it is the book of the law. Adam Clark says it's probably the book of the law, and I think it probably is. This would be the testimony of the will of God to the people and to the king. We're going to base this thing on God, not on Baal. The Holman Christian Study Bible margin here for testimony has this, or he gave, well, I'm going to have to paraphrase it, or Jehoiada gave Joash the copy of the covenant, or a diadem, or jewels. Gave him a crown, gave him some jewels. I like testimony better. Then Jehoiada anointed him. This is what you do to kings. Interesting. This is probably from John Gill. Jewish writers say that ordinarily a king's son was not anointed, but because of the usurpation of Athaliah, Joash was anointed. Well, I don't know about that. I thought kings were always anointed. Solomon was anointed, but because of Adonijah's usurpation, they anointed Solomon. One interesting fact here from 2 Chronicles 13:11, it says that Jehoiada and his sons anointed him. So in the ceremony, not only did you have the high priest, but you had the sons of the high priest, of course, who would inherit the high priesthood as time goes on. Now, the interesting thing about this is one of the sons of Jehoiada was a priest named Zechariah, and Joash, this little seven-year-old boy, when he grew up, killed Zechariah later on, which is an expression of gross ingratitude. We read about this in 2 Chronicles 24, verses 20 through 22. Then the Spirit of God came on Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada the priest, and he stood above the people and said to them, "Thus God has said, why do you transgress the commandments of the Lord and do not prosper? Because you have forsaken the Lord, he has forsaken you." So these priests were also prophets, speaking by the Spirit of the Lord. So they conspired against him, and at the command of the king, they stoned him to death. That king is little King Joash, who's grown up. They stoned Zechariah, the son of Jehoiada, to death in the court of the house of the Lord. Thus Joash the king did not remember the kindness which his father Jehoiada had shown him, but he murdered his son. And as he died, Zechariah the son died, he said, "May the Lord see and avenge." Well, that's a sad story. Boy, there's nothing worse than ingratitude. You kill him. You kill the son of the high priest who protected you for 7 years from being murdered, for 6 years from being murdered, and then who put you on the throne and anointed you with oil. Well, back to happier times. At the beginning of Joash's reign, when he's only 7 years old, the people are clapping. They anoint after the anointing, they're clapping. This is the first instance of clapping, by the way, in the Bible, as Adam Clark says, clapping for joy, at least. Now, in verse 14, Athaliah hears the noise. Verse 13, I'm sorry, when Athaliah heard the noise from the guard and the crowd, that's the clapping, the screaming, "Long live the king." Now, you can imagine what a shock that must have been, because everything had been done in deep secrecy. Nobody knew about this conspiracy. It was a great conspiracy. Nobody spilled the beans. And she's saying, "Now, wait a minute. What's going on out here?" And then she hears, "Long live the king?" Oh, boy. Long live the king? No wonder she yelled, "Treason, treason." She knew what was happening. It was immediately obvious. Now, she went, in verse 13, she went from the palace to the temple, and she went unattended, because she was surprised, I'm sure. She didn't have time to get her guards together. She was admitted to pass the guards, not her guards, but Jehoiada's guards. Why did Jehoiada's guards let her in to see all the ceremony? Well, she was the queen. Maybe they were intimidated by her, and she was unattended. She didn't have troops with her. It could be that Jehoiada said, "Let her in." If he did, that would be a particular order, contrary to the general orders he gave in this chapter, 2 Kings 11, verse 8. When he told his soldiers, or his priest, "You must completely surround the king with weapons in hand. Anyone who approaches the ranks is to be put to death. You must be with the king in all of his daily task." Well, Jehoiada, in this case, said, "Okay, let her in." Why would he do this? Maybe he has a better chance of killing her to do this. But I think it's because she's unattended. She has no troops. Jehoiada knows he's got her. Nothing to worry about. So Jehoiada, as she comes through the crowd of people in the courtyard, as she goes through the soldiers or the armed priest, as she approaches the altar of burnt offering, she sees the little boy standing by the pillar according to the custom. Now, what is this pillar according to the custom? Well, as Adam Clark says, this is the place or throne on which they were accustomed to put the kings when they proclaimed them. And I imagine there's translation problems here. Some of the translations say the post, but the commentators speculate it's either a pillar he stands by or a throne he sits on. Now, we see this pillar mentioned in 2 Kings 23:3. "Next, the king stood by the pillar and made a covenant." Now, the king being talked about in this verse, 2 Kings 23:3, is King Josiah, not Joash, but Josiah, but he stood by the pillar. And in 2 Chronicles 34:31, we see the same King Josiah taking his place by the pillar, at least in the Bible and Basic English translation. So it's either a pillar or it's a throne, as I said. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said it was a platform erected for the purpose of proclamation of kings. He refers to 2 Chronicles 6:13. Now Solomon had made a bronze platform, 5 cubits long, 5 cubits wide, and 3 cubits high, and had set it in the midst of the court, and he stood on it, knelt on his knees in the presence of all the assemblies of Israel, and spread out his hands toward heaven. Well, if little King Josiah is standing on this bronze platform, if that's what the Hebrew word for pillar is there, well, then it's quite obvious to Athaliah that she's in a world of trouble. And you notice it's according to custom. So apparently kings always stood there for either secular or religious business. But she knew when she saw that, the gig was up, especially when she heard everybody crying, "Long live the king." She yells, "Treason, treason." She's apparently trying to get people to rally to her side, because treason's a very powerful word. People don't like to commit treason because they know if they do it and get caught, they get their heads chopped off. Or it could be she's just expostulating because she's shocked at what's happened, and she yells treason, not really having a strategy behind it, but just yelling out of emotion. We go to 2 Kings 11, verses 15 through 16. And Jehoiada the priest commanded the captains of hundreds who were appointed over the army, and said to them, "Bring her out between the ranks, and whoever follows her, put her to death with the sword." For the priest said, "Let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord." So they seized her, and when she arrived at the horse's entrance of the king's house, that's the king's palace, she was put to death there. Now, the captains of hundreds who were appointed over the army, that's an army of priests and Levites, as Gillen Bitson points out. You hear army, you don't think priests and Levites, but in this case it was. Bring her out between the ranks. Those are those ranks that I said were either running north, south, or east, west. I think it's east, west. She's standing there in front of the bronze altar. The soldiers are lined up between the porch, the altar, probably beyond the altar too. And she's standing there somewhere in between those ranks. And Jehoiada says, "Take her out between the soldiers there. Anybody that follows her," in other words, with the purpose of aiding her in maintaining her throne, put them to death too. And so they took her out and executed her. We go to 2 Kings 11, 17 through 21, and we'll finish this audio. Then Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people, that they should be the Lord's people, also between the king and the people. Two covenants there, the Lord, the king, and the people, and between the king and the people. And all the people of the land went to the house of Baal and tore it down. His altars and his images they broke in pieces thoroughly, and killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. That's M-A-T-T-A-N. And the priest appointed officers over the house of the Lord. And he took the captains of hundreds, and the Kerites, and the guards, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, and came by the way of the gate of the guards to the king's house, and he sat on the throne of the kings. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet, for they had put Athaliah to death with the sword at the king's house. They didn't wait for the legal means of execution. They didn't try her. They just whacked her. Generally, that's not a good idea, but they did it. Verse 21, Joash was 7 years old when he became king. Now let's look at these two covenants that were made. The first covenant was between the Lord, the king, and the people. That, of course, would be a renewal of the national covenant of Israel, the Mosaic covenant, which we can read about in Exodus 19, 1 through Exodus 24, 18, the famous covenant of Mount Sinai. Once they made that covenant, then they made a covenant between the king, Joash, and the people. So Joash, just as he had made a covenant with the Lord, made a covenant with his people. Now, of course, he's 7 years old, so we know that Jehoiada is directing the ceremonies here. Here's what Clark says, quote, "A general covenant was first made between the Lord, the supreme king, the king, his viceroy, that's Joash, and the people, that they should all be the Lord's people, Yahweh's people, each being equally bound to live according to the divine law. Then secondly, a particular covenant was made between the king, Joash, and the people, by which the king, Joash, was bound to rule according to the laws and constitution of the kingdom, and watch and live for the safety of the republic. And the people were bound on their part to love, honor, succor, and obey the king." Oh, wouldn't it be nice if we had kings and populations that loved each other and supported each other like that, all under the watchful eye of Yahweh. But we don't. And as a result, we have total chaos, moral inversions, sickness, oppressions, fear. In other words, the way people are living in America now. Now, the people get so excited about this covenant, they went and tore down the house of Baal. Now, that house of Baal, that temple, Baal temple was either in Jerusalem or near it. It perhaps was at the Mount of Olives, because the Mount of Olives was called the Mount of Corruption in 2 Kings 23:13. Mount of Corruption, or New American Standard Bible has the Mount of Destruction and the high places which were before Jerusalem, which were on the right of the Mount of Destruction, which Solomon, the king of Israel, had built for Ashtoreth, the abomination of the Sidonians, and for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Milcom, the abomination of the sons of Ammon, the king defiled. That king was Josiah that defiled all these idols on the Mount of Olives. Well, wherever it was, it doesn't matter. It was torn down. This is exactly what happened to the mount, to the house of Baal in Samaria, which Jehu had turned into a latrine. We just read about that. I think it was the previous chapter, maybe the one before. Who had built this house of Baal? It could have been Athaliah, or it could have been there since the days of Solomon. However long it was there, it was gone now. Now, it was logical that Jehoiada would start the reign of Joash with tearing the temple of Baal down. We read in 2 Chronicles 24:7, "For the sons of the wicked Athaliah had broken into the house of God and even used the holy things of the house of the Lord for the Baals." So this piece of work of Athaliah had gone into the holy temple of God, taken the utensils, and then put them in her Baal temple. Well, Jehoiada, a godly man of Yahweh, a priest of Yahweh, is not going to stand for that. So he said, yeah, let's go tear it down. Tear down the temple of Baal. Verse 18, other images are destroyed besides Baal's. That would be out of the gods. Pagan temples often had images of other gods in them. Well, they were wiped out too. And then Jehoiada appointed officers over the house of the Lord. Why did he do that? Well, because worship services had been neglected under Athaliah, and so the temple worship was not being carried out. And so Jehoiada appointed people to take care of that. We read about that in 2 Chronicles 23:18-19. "Moreover, Jehoiada placed the offices of the house of the Lord under the authority of the Levitical priest, whom David had assigned over the house of the Lord, to offer the burnt offerings of the Lord, as it is written in the law of Moses, with rejoicing and singing according to the order of David. And he stationed the gatekeepers of the house of the Lord, so that no one should enter who was in any way unclean." All right, so the temple of Yahweh is up and running again. Got people working it. The temple of Baal is destroyed and torn down. Priests brought Jehoiada and his army of priests brought the king down from the house of the Lord. The temple's on a hill, so he came down, went by the way of the gate of the guards into the king's house, into his palace where he's going to sit. He sat on the throne of the kings. That was in Solomon's palace, probably somewhere. So all the people of the land rejoiced. They needed to rejoice because the line of David had almost been extinguished. Think how bad the Israelites felt when the line of David was extinguished, when Zedekiah was killed by the Babylonians in the 6th century B.C. Well, it had almost happened to them a lot earlier. So, ladies and gentlemen, on that high and happy note, we have now finished 2 Kings chapter 11. In our next audio, we will turn to 2 Kings chapter 12, and we will see Joash repairing the temple. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.